previously on Popping Collars.
You know, if you had had a Game of Thrones homecoming, like, you're not getting the same.
I don't want to go. No.
It's gonna be rough. It's gonna be a lot of detail, and there's gonna be two guys in a corner who are gonna debate whether the house sigil is correct.
No, but Betsy, why would you give Game of Thrones homecoming week when they have the whole year? Like, homecoming is
That's true.
That's a week off of middle school life.
That is true. That's a good point.
Okay. All right. Welcome to Popping Collars, the podcast that lives in the space between meaning and culture. My name is Liz Easton. I'm the canon to the ordinary of the Diocese of Nebraska. And with me today are my co-hosts, Greg Knight. Greg, where are you and what do you do?
Hey, Liz. I am in Palm Beach, Florida, where I am the Director of Children and Youth Ministries at the Church of Bethesda by the Sea.
Awesome. And Ricardo Avila, where are you and what do you do?
I just want to say, have I been promoted to co-host?
You're a co-host.
Right. We had a whole special conversation about this, Ricardo.
I know, but the listeners don't know this.
Yeah. Okay. Listeners, Ricardo's been promoted.
So I am the interim rector at St. Luke's Episcopal Church in Long Beach, California, which is just south of Los Angeles.
Our special guest today on this episode is Brother James Dowd, who is actually appearing live and in person in my dining room right now, which is the Popping Collars first. Brother James, where are you? Who are you and what do you do?
I am in the beating heart of America here in Omaha, Nebraska. And I am the monk in residence for the Diocese of Nebraska.
What is a monk in residence, Brother James?
An excellent question, one we continue to explore. Now, a monk in residence works with various folks throughout the diocese on both their spiritual journeys and in our work with the poor and the marginalized.
So this is our 53rd episode of Popping Collars, and it's right in time for the presidential inauguration. Our topic today is presidential portrayals in pop culture. Say that three times fast. So from Josiah Bartlett on The West Wing to Thomas J. Whitmore in Independence Day, film and television seems to love to create fantasy presidents for us. And then, of course, you've got all of the fictionalized portrayals of real life presidents like Daniel Day-Lewis in Lincoln or Josh Brolin in W. It seems like the president of the United States looms really large in our national lives. So it just makes sense that they have a lot of portrayal in pop culture, too. So my question for all of you guys is, who is your favorite fake president?
I'm going to cheat because it's not a president of the United States. Does that count?
No. I'm not sure, but try us.
My favorite presidential portrayal is President Roslin from Battlestar Galactica, which is kind of... This is where it gets a little weird because, yes, it's a sci-fi show, and yes, it's not set on the planet Earth, but it has similar structure to how we have our president here in the States. Like, the president was elected and stuff. But the cool thing about her, she wasn't president. She was like Secretary of Education or something like that. But like, their planet gets wiped out, and she's the only one sort of in the line of succession that can sort of step into this role of president. And
the designated survivor.
Right. Well, but not designated, right? It was a total accident, right? Their society was wiped out by robots. And so she just happened to be the last person left. And I think what appeals to me about that is, just like longtime listeners will know, that Liz likes movies and TV shows where people do their jobs well.
My favorite.
I'm a sucker for when people are put in positions that they're not prepared for and they step up to the challenge. I love the way that, you know, she's in a position where a lot of is expected of her and she didn't ask for it.
I still don't know if that counts, but okay.
I don't think it counts either, yeah. But okay. What about you, Ricardo? Who's your favorite fake president?
Well, I just want to comment on what you guys just said. Liz, you apparently you like shows or movies where people are doing their jobs well. And yes, the first thought that ran through my mind was, gee, that really is fiction. That doesn't really happen in reality. And then Greg said, oh, he loves it when people are thrust into situations they're not ready for. And I thought, that's exactly my reality. And many people's, right? So maybe in that sense, you can get a pass, Greg.
Thank you.
You know, I'm going to cheat a little bit, too. My favorite presidential portrayal is from a movie I haven't seen. I was going to say Harrison Ford in Air Force One.
Yeah.
Just because I really like Harrison Ford. And
sexy
I think
president.
He's kind of a sexy president, and he, like, punches someone. I saw that scene. He punches the bad guy.
To try to save Air Force One.
And there was something about seeing a president be, like, macho for real, and it being Harrison Ford that was good, even in that little scene I saw. And I may have more to say about, like, sexy presidential portrayals later if I'm allowed.
And you know what? Talk about Air Force One. Glenn Close, who plays the vice president, in probably her second or third campiest role ever. It is completely worth seeing just for that.
That's saying something.
Brother James, do you have a favorite fake president?
Well, come on. I have to say, you'll probably say the same thing. Martin Sheen in The West Wing. But a very close second is Michael Douglas in The American President.
I was going to say that one.
Which is done by the same creators. Yep. They just switched roles. Martin Sheen plays the chief of staff in the film.
Right.
The American President. But Martin Sheen.
Just Martin Sheen.
Yeah.
I was going to say The American President, too, because I used to – that's one of my mom's favorite movies. So whenever it came on TV or whatever, we would watch it, and she would always get – you know, because it's very romantic.
Right.
It's like a kind of a great romantic comedy. In our West Wing episode, which we recorded last season, or maybe it was longer ago than that, we sort of talked about how the Bartlett administration, the Bartlett White House, was sort of a fantasy creation of liberals who were escaping the reality of a Bush White House, which I think is true. And I think what you might be able to say about presidents in pop culture is that there's a lot of projection and fantasy going on. So I just am finding myself wondering what our next season of presidential portrayals might look like, when our real president is himself a pop culture star.
If we were doing the opposite.
Yeah.
So maybe it would be, you know, someone who, first of all, had an abnormal amount of humility.
I see a female president. That might be too stark for people to take. But with humility, gosh, who? Meryl Streep.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking of your list, Liz. Okay, so if I'm looking for a common denominator of what those presidents are, they tend to be very leaderly. So, like, I'm thinking of the American president, Michael Douglas gets out there, and he's doing a speech. It's to Congress, so it must be, like, the State of the Union or something, right? And it's this soaring thing where at the end of the speech, even Richard Dreyfuss, his longtime opponent, is just swept up into this amazing leadership that this man possesses. And the same thing with Independence Day, right? I mean, the whole movie is built on this sort of grand, epic leader, you know, taking charge and giving this stirring speech that rouses the troops to fight back against the aliens. I think it feels like presidential portrayals in pop culture aren't really presidential to me. While there are occasionally decent speeches, they tend to be sort of in very small chunks, and there's always somebody that disagrees with whatever that person is saying. I think that there's this idea of what a president is, but the reality of our presidents rarely reaches that.
After President Truman ordered the dropping of the atomic bombs in Japan, not long after that, a lot of political philosophers talked about the fact that American people changed during the course of the late 40s and 50s in the way they viewed the president, that they viewed the president now as a father figure who had to protect them in a way that prior to the bomb, it was just a different story. I think that was maintained all the way through at least old man Bush. And somehow that's fallen apart in a way that ultimately could be a good thing. He's not our father, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. but also has an implication for what we actually think about this person, both in reality and in popular culture. You know, finally, the speech is made and everybody goes, that's right. You know, dad's been right all along.
You know, as you say that, that makes me realize it seems like the two main conduits for Trump's communication is our rallies and tweets. And in both of those situations, you're a step removed from actual engagement and communication. You get to throw out these little like bite-sized things. And then rallies, you just get to say a loud thing to a whole bunch of people. You don't actually have to sit down and, you know, practice humility or practice, you know, linear thinking. And, you know, he does it really well. And I'm ready anytime to go to the sexy president thing, by the way. I've like thought of five as we were sitting here.
I think that's a segue, and I love it. So
I didn't see W, but the idea of Josh Brolin playing George W. Bush, I already liked George W. Bush better. Like, it affected my thinking.
It occurs to me, of course, that everyone that we're talking about is a white man.
Yeah.
That it's still the presidents of our imagination seem to be white men. And I did a little bit of research about this and was looking up presidential portrayals of women. In 1964, there was the film Kisses for My President. Has anyone seen that?
No.
Kisses for My President.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and Polly Bergen plays the first woman president. And it's sort of a movie about that experience in 1964. And her spouse is all, struggling because he can't figure out what it means to be the first husband. And then get this. She gets pregnant while in the Oval Office and resigns. So that's our very first portrayal of a woman president. And of course, there have been other good portrayals, but it seems like a lot of the time it's a little bit silly and sort of playing to.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus, right? I mean, that's the most recent kind of example. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And there's a ton of portrayals of African-American presidents. Well, not a ton, but some, which includes, of course, Morgan Freeman twice.
I'm wondering, because I don't really have a great memory when it comes to political movies and especially sort of presidential portrayals. Before Reagan was president, I'm curious what presidential figures looked like in movies, because once you have an actor in the role of president, it strikes me that that kind of dictates what the role of president looks like.
Prior to that time, they usually portrayed presidents where you didn't see much of them. You'd hear a voice, you'd see their back, especially if it was FDR or JFK, you know, who were these great heroes and all of that. They were treated almost like the way like the Pope is treated in films, you know, like, you know, you don't want to quite, you know, focus on it. And that all broke down, I think, at Reagan's time, because the man did, you know, movies with chimps.
I want to say something about women as president. You've heard it said that America won't go to the movies when there's a female superhero. You know, like they're not going to go to that movie. They want to see the man up there or whatever. And I wonder how much of that is true of having a female presidential portrayal. And of course, there is Hillary Clinton, and how many people just couldn't stomach a female president. Portrayals, like when it doesn't jibe with my kind of the grooves in understanding in my brain of how a president should look, it distracts or upsets. And I'm speaking on behalf of, I'm sure, some Americans of, oh, that's inappropriate, you know?
What about priests?
Well, I was about to say priests and bishops. I think that we're running into this still all the time, that people look to, in a lot of folks' minds, there is still sort of a category of priest or of bishop that happens to be a white man most of the time. Mm-hmm. And as people, I think, start studying and kind of exploring why it's becoming so hard for women to be elected as bishops, I think that that's a huge piece of it.
Bishops, you're right, though. Yeah, we just had an election in L.A., and there were two local female candidates, and they were the first to drop out, I believe, because they were getting the lowest votes. And I noted that, and it was not cool.
Mm-mm. Well, I wonder, you know, with both the president and with Bishop, if the father figure thing about the president is, the theory is correct or holds some water at least, you can see people transferring a similar idea to a bishop. Historically, we've certainly always thought of them as men because that's all they ever could be until recently. I remember thinking long before this particular presidential election, you know, if that theory is right, would a woman ever be able to get that? Because if what you're talking about is your survival, who will protect us from the bombs falling, right? What does that mean for people, you know, emotionally? Mm-hmm. And how does that, and obviously a bishop doesn't have that kind of power, but bishop has some power over your life, certainly if you're clergy.
Did you see the movie Moneyball with Brad Pitt a few years back? You know, ostensibly about baseball, but like the cool thing about that movie was that it had basically two ways of thinking about the world. You could either believe narratives about baseball, which is sort of like passed down common knowledge, or you could trust the statistics of like what the players were actually doing. Brad Pitt plays this general manager who all of a sudden, instead of just believing the narrative, starts trusting the statistics more and builds his team around that idea. But those narratives hold so much weight. Like if you just look at the last election cycle, the two main candidates, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton was painted as someone who was untrustworthy. That was the narrative that stuck to her. And Donald Trump was the narrative. There were several narratives, but one that stuck with him was that, well, except, you know, he tells it like it is and he would protect us. He would keep us safe. And I think that there is a gender dynamic there. There's this idea that, well, I can't trust this woman, but this man, I mean, he can keep us safe, right? And the funny thing is that now you know that, well, actually, he's the thin-skinned one. He's the one that can't stand up to any criticism whatsoever. Like, the statistics don't bear out the narrative that we kind of convinced ourselves over the year of what these people were.
The Episcopal Church welcomes you no matter where you are. And I take it seriously, like, okay, if you voted for Trump and we can't hold you in this space, then we're not living with integrity in a sense. But it's been really difficult as I come to know more people who voted for Trump. I love them as people, but there's something in the back of my mind, like when I picture Trump making fun of the disabled reporter, which is what Meryl Streep referenced in her speech at the Golden Globes, and when I picture some of the things he said and how he just got a pass on all that from his supporters, I lose a little, in my estimation, some of those people who voted for Trump that I know and love lose a little bit of moral standing in my kind of in my soul. I can't help it. How could you do that? Did you not see what he did to that person and said to that person? So it's everywhere and it's deep.
I think it's super hard. And one of the things that we learned, you know, in seminary and before that and after that is no matter what, you do not use a candidate's name from the pulpit. No matter what, you do not talk about partisan politics from the pulpit. That's true for our tax standing and all of that. You need to be very careful to not be influencing votes from the pulpit. But there's always a moral connection between politics and morality. But it feels like that has become even more stark right now. So it's almost like, how can I not? How can I not talk about this from the pulpit explicitly? But there's certain language I have found that if you use, people immediately turn off, or they immediately think you are trying to belittle my vote or take away that sacred responsibility from me or whatever. It just feels like a minefield more than usual. I mean, the part that just gets me, there's a lot of this that gets me, but I think about the Access Hollywood tapes.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
And how vulgar those were. And I know that everybody had a variety of responses to them. But to me, it took a long time before I was able to even say those. Brother James was in the car with me when we read it, and I couldn't read it out loud. I was like, you guys, it's bad, but I can't say it out loud. That's how vulgar it was for me. Mm-hmm. So to think that Billy Bush got fired from a daytime television show for being in the same room as somebody who's joking about sexual assault, and the person who made the joke was elected president, that preaches. Right? That preaches. You have to preach on that. But it's so complicated.
So I was thinking about Ricardo's comment about people who supported this candidate who said these vile things. You're right. I mean, there's no moral justification for the things that he says. And so that takes your estimation of them down a peg. But do you think that that says something about how we hold things with integrity in our parishes? It's like, because, I mean, you know, honestly, like I'm reading texts from the Bible that I have to kind of justify sometimes and, you know, have to kind of hold loosely and say, I don't know. I don't know where God is here, but I'm going to trust that somehow through history we arrived at this point because this particular thing got written. Like sometimes I look around these gorgeous cathedrals that we have and I think like, what are we doing? Like where is the gospel in this? Like what are we even doing here? Like, I mean, there's an integrity thing there, it feels like to me. Brother James, so when you work with people in their spiritual lives, and as the person of holy orders yourself, like, you know, how do you sort of find yourself navigating through this world of like values?
This afternoon, I was talking to four friends via a Skype call, and the five of us have a kind of contemplative prayer group together. We're scattered all over the country. And I talked about the fact that that something's been happening in me since the election that has never happened in my life before, which is that occasionally, once or twice a week, I will have a reaction that is almost like panic. Like I think, this can't be happening. I'm going to wake up soon and, you know, it's all none of this will have been true. And because what disturbs me is what I hear from people that in spiritual direction or in one-on-ones when I go from parish to parish or in the cathedral here in Omaha, where I work a lot, there's a large group of people who are so freaked out in a way that they have never been, I've never heard before in an election. You know, and back when Reagan was elected in 1980, there were a lot of people who were really freaked out by that. Okay. They thought he was completely irresponsible, and he was. But this is a different thing because Reagan was still willing to work within the law and mostly, and within the rules of American politics. We are at a time in history that will be marked as something ended on November 8th, a way we lived together as a society. And now this new thing has begun where it's not one lie that you accept. Every politician, there's something that everybody kind of goes, oh, okay, we're just going to look the other way on that, right? Mm-hmm. It's not that. It's from his announcement in 2015, when he started talking about Mexican rapists, mm-hmm. that alone should have disqualified him right then and there, right? And it went on from there, the disabled reporter and the things he said about women that came out in October and so many things in between. And yet every single time, an enormous group of people said, this is okay. He doesn't really mean it.
It's just locker room talk.
It's just locker room talk, right? So spiritually, what I hear from people is this kind of, they are bereft and they are, they feel alone in the world. And often I'm asked, where's God? Mm-hmm. How could God have let this happen? It's the kind of thing where the only thing I know to do, and it's literally the only thing I know to do, is to keep going back to prayer. Because what liturgical prayer does is bring us together as a community. And as hard as it is, Ricardo, I understand, to know there are Trump people sitting out there as, you know, as you're presiding at the Eucharist or something, or at least we're all together and we're praying and we're trying to be decent people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In a weird way, maybe this is just going to somehow challenge us to expand our idea of who to have compassion for or how to have compassion for other people. Wow, these people, I could just vilify almost half of the country and say they are just crazy messed up. How could they ever? And I do, you know, my mind, that whole thing of like the moral estimation has dropped for some people. But if we're supposed to love everyone, how do we change our Christian hearts to welcome people that we truly think who don't care about other people? I don't know. I don't know what to call them. So, and maybe some of that wrestling is going to actually bear some good fruit. I don't know. The other thing is, I think it's going to get some people off their butts and really into the streets.
Yeah. Part of what's always been really hard for me about partisan politics is the sort of shaming and finger pointing at the people who disagree with you for whatever reason. And it's especially when, for me, when people are saying, oh, they're stupid. All those people are stupid, because I mean, I just don't think it's true. You know, it's not true. And that has been really hard for me also recently to think, you know, here in Nebraska, many of our, I don't have a parish, right? I have a whole state of full of congregations that I work with. And many of them are in some of the most Republican counties in the United States. And I know them to be smart, faithful, loving, fierce people. There's something that I don't know.
One of the things I want to say is going back to that idea of why do we want a certain kind of presidential portrayal in movies? And is it a response to what's going on in the world? Greg, what you were saying about having, you know, those presidents who give those rousing speeches, et cetera, we want certainty, even more than sexy, even more maybe than male, female. We want certainty. We want clarity. We want rightness and righteousness to prevail. And it's just so messy for any president, even the best intention.
Final segment is new in the third season of Popping Collars, and it's called Employee Picks. So it's like back in the day when you went to Blockbuster Video or to your local bookstore and an employee made a pick, and then you were like, oh, I always love Brother James's picks. I'm going to see what he's into.
What would be the modern equivalent? Like a Spotify playlist or something? I don't know.
Well, I think they still have a bookstore as Employee Picks.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Certainly at independent bookstores.
There you go.
So we're doing employee picks. And I hear that Ricardo has an employee pick.
Well, thank you, Liz. As a matter of fact, I do. I for some reason, I like the idea of staff pick. That just got a thing to
it. Oh, that's right. Staff pick. Yeah.
My staff pick. My staff pick, you know, I am pretty old school. And so I'm not going to go to the 19th century here, but I will go to the 1950s and 60s. I have lately been, I've watched all five seasons of The Twilight Zone from the 50s and early 60s, and I've loved it. You know, they're not all great, but it's pretty amazing. And also, I have seen over the last number of years, six seasons of Alfred Hitchcock Presents. Do you remember that? Right? And with Alfred Hitchcock with this awful, droll little presentation before and after that was never funny, but you sort of couldn't help watching. So I have, having seen five seasons of Twilight Zone, all five, and six of the 10 of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, I've been comparing them in my mind. I think they're all worth watching. I think they are tremendously binge-worthy because they're all very different. I would say Alfred Hitchcock Presents is it's more about entertainment, and you know, there's domestic stuff that goes on. You know, the woman who kills her husband with a frozen turkey leg, and then the investigators come and she cooks the turkey leg. They're looking for the weapon. They're looking for the weapon, and they're eating it. She invites them to dinner, right? So that's great. Whereas The Twilight Zone, and I've had conversations about this, it's a little more about it's politically minded. It has an agenda. It wants to tell you things. It wants to say, look, if we keep going like this, the world's going to be a wasteland. Oh, look, we're going to outer space to find other people, and oh, they're just like us, but we're worse. Or you know, a lot of commentary on humanity, and not usually positive. So I give Twilight Zone the edge in terms of social relevance, and I give Alfred Hitchcock the edge in terms of just like, I think the acting is a little better and the entertainment level is actually more varied, oddly enough. Twilight Zone's palette is, you know, outer space, travel through time, but for some reason, the human scale of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, I think, has a lot more you can do with it.
Twilight Zone's incredible. Like, Rod Serling is one of the most creative writers ever. Like, I mean, Ricardo underplays it because he says like five seasons. There's 40 episodes a season of the Twilight Zone. That's a lot of episodes that Rod Serling put out. It's crazy.
Thank you to Greg and to Ricardo and to James. Thank you for listening. You guys may notice.
Your thanks is effusive.
You can find us on the internet at poppingcollarspodcast.com, where you can see all of our podcasts. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher and other places where people get their podcasts. And you can also find us on the Episcopal Cafe, where we are a member of their podcasting network. We love the Episcopal Cafe, and we know that you will too. Thanks, guys.
And right. Keep those collars popped.
Exactly.
Pop, pop.